Now, the debugger that I'm going to use is an add-on to Firefox. It's already installed. It's called Firebug. And the way I invoke Firebug is the following. I'm going to right-click on this little Firebug window, this little Firebug icon, and I'm going to say Enable All Panels. And then I'm going to hit F12 twice. Once I do this magic dance, and it's documented in your books, I can open the script tab, and I see the malicious script at the bottom pane here. This is Firebug showing me the script. What do I want to do with the script? Well, here's what I want to do. What I would like to do is the following. Here's the eval. It's evaluating the TXT variable. If I'm already here, the script would have deobfuscated itself and now it's trying to execute it. So I'm going to use Firebug to set a breakpoint at eval. And then I'm going to execute the script within Firefox. Firefox will know what to do to deobfuscate the script, and as soon as it's deobfuscated, Firefox is going to pause because I would have reached this breakpoint. And then I'm going to use Firebug to look at contents of the variable txt. Here's how I do this. Right now I'm still paused. Scripting is disabled. I found eval txt. I right-click there and I say set breakpoint. You see the little big dot? The big dot says breakpoint has been set. Now that I set my breakpoint, I can execute this script. And the way I do it is I click on the no script icon in the bottom right corner and I say temporarily allow. Temporarily allow scripting. Don't allow it forever. We're only allowing it temporarily for this particular experiment. So, as soon as I click temporarily allow, this enables scripting temporarily and reloads the page. And right away, I hit my breakpoint. So at this point, the script executed, deobfuscated itself, and it's about to call eval txt. If it's evaluating contents of txt, that means that txt contains the deobfuscated script that it's trying to run. So I'm going to use Firebug to look at contents of the variable txt. In the right pane, you see Firebug showing you all the currently defined variables, and txt is one of those variables. And you can already see that in it, there are some JavaScript contents. The easiest way that I found in Firebug to look at contents of a variable is to go to the console tab, and at the bottom of the console tab, you can type your commands, and the command is console.log. And then in parentheses, you specify the name of the variable, which in this case is txt. And then you press enter, and it shows you the deobfuscated script. So here it is. So there were a lot of steps here, but once you do it, you'll see that actually this is a very repeatable process that works pretty well. The only slightly tricky part that's a little bit weird is how to bring up Firebug to begin with. And I have instructions for doing this in your books. What you gotta do is the following. Once you load the script into Firefox and scripting is disabled, to set your breakpoint to bring up Firebug, what you gotta do is you gotta click on the little bug icon, you right click on it, and you say enable all panels. If you don't do this, sometimes the script panel in Firebug is disabled for efficiency purposes. So we wanna enable it. And then you gotta hit F12, press off, and hit F12 again.
What's the off button?
The off button, this is what forces Firebug to reload its configuration so that all panels are enabled. It's a little bit awkward, but that's just, I haven't found a better way to do it in Firebug. So, try this out in your lab. The instructions for doing this begin on page 113, and if you get stuck, just let me know and I'll help you out. It begins on 113, and it ends on page 117. Don't go into the next example, just finish this one, 113 until 117. A cheat sheet on how to analyze a malicious PDF document and malicious Microsoft Office documents. And that's just for your information. We're actually not going to cover that topic in the course. But if you're wondering how to handle PDF files and Office document files, then the most important tools and the approaches are summarized in that one pager that I prepared. Yeah. Well, so PDFs are a huge attack vector nowadays.
Yeah.
If you want to figure out how to deal with them, my advice is summarized in that one page. But I also just finished preparing additional courseware for this course that's going to expand it to 5 days. Right now it's a 4-day course. Actually, in a couple of months, or maybe in a month, I'm going to, for the first time, teach a fifth day. And that fifth day covers analyzing PDF documents, analyzing Microsoft Office documents, and it also covers how to use memory forensics techniques to analyze malware. It's really cool stuff. Those of you who want to learn that stuff, you will have the option of just signing up for that fifth day if you want to later this year. So if these topics are interesting to you, then Sans can give you a discount code so that you only pay for that fifth day and you can attend a conference where I teach that day five. If you're going to be, say, in Las Vegas or in Washington, D.C. or in Baltimore later this year. But also I'm going to be teaching those materials online in August. So if you don't feel like traveling and if your company is willing to, you know, cover the cost of just paying for day five, you can sign up for the VLive version of this course. It's going to start in July, and this is where I'm going to be teaching these materials over the internet twice a week. And those two evening sessions in August are going to cover new day five materials.
Is that interactive? Or
it's interactive. Yeah, it's interactive. There's like a chat session. You can ask questions. So anyway, if you want that kind of stuff, it's available to you. You can sign up for it. If you go to the SANS website for the course, you'll see where you can attend it if you want. If you've got any questions, feel free to ask afterwards.
Awesome.
Also, another thing in terms of announcements, those of you who would like, tomorrow we're going to go to a happy hour that is sponsored by Norman, the security company. They make a malware analysis tool called Norman Sandbox. So those guys are willing to take all of you out for drinks tomorrow after class right at the hotel bar. So you know what? You know, and they're pretty good. They don't like try to sell you their tool there. It's very low key. They just hang out and, you know, drink and it's all free. So if you'd like to join us, 5:15 after class tomorrow, we're going to go to the hotel bar and just hang out there. And, you know, Norman is picking up the tab.
Do we have to sign up?
No, no sign up. Just, you know, come along after class. That's all. All right. So I want to show you another example because you can see that things can get a little bit more complicated than what I just showed you. And this is a second example that shows you slightly more complex situations. This is an example that's also in that file called under day two, and it's a file called data.zip. Now, if you unzip data.zip and you look at data.html, the way on Remnux that you can look at files, there's a pretty good text editor that you can invoke by typing Notepad. It's actually a text editor called Citee. But nobody remembers Citee, so I just aliased it so that when you call Notepad, it's actually going to bring up Citee. So here is what that script looks like. Let me bring it up on my screen. If you cannot see it, it's in your books on page 113. This is a brand new example, so I'm going to exit Firefox, and I'm going to unzip data.zip. Usually when I'm dealing with an obfuscated or a malicious page, I first look at it using a text editor like Citee. So I'm going to bring up Notepad, also known as Citee, and here is this malicious page. Look at all this obfuscated stuff. Who knows what's going on in here? Who knows? But also, there is, if you look carefully, a command called eval MDR. So somewhere in here, there's a script that knows how to deobfuscate the original script. It does it magically. Well, not magically, but, you know, we don't know how exactly it does it. And then there's an eval command that executes the deobfuscated script, and it looks like it's executing it within the variable called MDR. We can use Firebug, just like we did before, to look at contents of MDR. But there's something that you need to keep in mind, a limitation of Firebug. The limitation is that you can only set breakpoints in the beginning of the line. But this MGR command, it's actually in the middle of the line. Firebug won't let you set a breakpoint in the middle of the line. Not a problem. All that it means is you gotta edit the script first, and you gotta make sure that that line where you will want to set the breakpoint is in the beginning of the line. So I'm gonna do that. In fact, to make it easier for me, I'm gonna add it onto a line by itself. Now I'm gonna save this by clicking the floppy drive button. And now I can load this page into Firefox. So Firefox data.html. You may recall that scripting is disabled by default here. And now I can bring up Firebug, go to the script tab, and locate that line where I want to set my breakpoint. Here it is, eval. I click there, and I say set breakpoint. Now I can activate scripting. I go to no script, and I say temporarily allow. This reloads the page with scripting enabled. And if I go to console, I can type console.log MDR. And guess what? If you cannot see it on my screen, you will be able to see it on page 117 in your book. This is another obfuscated script. And this is quite common. Multiple layers of obfuscation. You strip away one layer, it's another obfuscated script. So you gotta do this several times. How do you handle it? Well, here's the approach. If you've deobfuscated the script and it is still obfuscated, here's what you need to do. What you need to do is take that script that you just deobfuscated and copy it to the clipboard. Then you gotta go back to the original script using Notepad. And you gotta edit it. And in place of the eval line, you get rid of that line, and in its place, you paste the deobfuscated segment. This is the segment that we just deobfuscated, but it's not meant to be executed by itself. It's meant to be executing within the context of this web page. So we're pasting it into this web page instead, in place of the eval statement. And now we start the process from the very beginning again. What do? Well, we gotta set a breakpoint somewhere. Well, what I wanna show you here is that there's a second common way in which malware will transfer control to the deobfuscated script. The first one is eval. The second most popular way is document.write. Basically works the same way, so look out for both eval and document.write. This is where I'm gonna set my breakpoint, and I will wanna look at contents of the variable q. To set my breakpoint, I need to make sure that it's in the beginning of the line. So I'm going to edit the script, and I'm going to make sure it's on a line by itself. Save. And now, exit Firefox, and do it again. Firefox, data.html. Look to the script tab. Whenever you see that nothing is in the script tab, you got to go through that little dance that I showed you earlier, where you right-click and you say, enable all panels, and you turn it off, and you turn it back on, and now you see the script. I had this documented in your books on page 114. All right, now I can see the script. Document.write is where I set my breakpoint. Temporarily allow scripting to reach the breakpoint, and now that I've reached that breakpoint, I go to the console, and I say, console.log q. And here is the deobfuscated script. Yeah, it's not very pretty on the eyes because it's all one big line. But if you take this and you reformat it in a text editor, you can actually read what's going on here. This might be a bit easier for you to see in the book on page, well, on page 125. And you can actually read this script and you will be able to spot references to what look like malicious URLs, like hoop.kazan.bz. There's a reference to a local file under the recycled folder. And you can actually see that there's a reference to an ActiveX object. It might be trying to invoke an ActiveX object to download a file, save it locally, and execute it. So now this is readable to you if you know how to read JavaScript. And in this case, yeah, it looks like it's just JavaScript as well as VBScript, language VBS. VBScript is a language that Internet Explorer supports. It's not unlike JavaScript. So my point is, to get to here, you need to use Firebug, but you need to do it twice because there are two layers of obfuscation. Try that in your lab. The instructions begin on page 118 and they end on 125. As always, if something is not clear to you, if you get stuck, please let me know. All right, so I'm going to continue, and here is where most of the difficulties you run into are. It's really, unfortunately, the interface of Firebug. Because Firebug is a fantastic tool, but the problem is that for whatever reason, it keeps disabling the script tab. And so you want to set your breakpoint, but you see the script tab is not enabled. The instructions for how to enable it are on page 114. But let me show it to you again because it's a little bit kludgy. What you got to do to enable the script tab is you right click on the little bug icon and you say enable all panels. But that's not enough. Now you got to restart Firebug, and the way you do it is you press this little corner button that looks like the off switch. And now you bring up Firebug again by pressing F12. And now the script tab is enabled. This is what's documented on page 114. And now once it's enabled, you can set your breakpoint. And then you can temporarily allow scripting. Now, you can edit, you can type at console to say console.log. In one case, one of you, for whatever reason, Firebug decided not to show you the line where you can type. If for whatever reason you cannot type in the console, you still have another way. What you could do is you can find the variable that you're interested in. Let's say it's Q. You can right-click on it, and you can say copy value. That's another way in which you can retrieve this value if, for whatever reason, the console is not working for you. Any questions about this example? Very powerful tool. We're going to show you additional examples of obfuscated, protected scripts on the last day of the class with some of the more complex situations. And you can see that malware authors can make our job quite a bit more difficult than what I had just shown you. But at its core, this is an approach that works pretty well. By the way, this was a copy of the Phoebe's worm. One of the ways in which it spread was by emailing itself as HTML attachments. Actually, the attachments had a .hta extension. And in those days, some Outlook clients were misconfigured so that if you ran a script from an attachment, it would run with local privileges, and it would allow the script to download and save and execute an executable file. So the goal of that script was to download and save a file that acted as a spyware. A lot of the attacks that you're going to be dealing with will have this multi-stage component where there's an attack happening in the browser, but the goal is oftentimes to install a malicious program. I wanted to show you one example of such an attack, and it began with an email message. The email message says that it has come to my attention that you are under a police investigation. Is that true? Have you really committed such a crime? Read the following article. And you know what? A lot of people who get this will probably be just confused enough that they will say, what? I'm going to click. And you know it's safe to click because the website is federalpolice.com. So let's say somebody in your organization clicks and realizes that they probably should not have done that. Or maybe they get this message and they say, hey, I know that this person is up to no good. They forward the message to you and ask you to investigate. So you probably, you know, you click, right? So what you probably will do is you will first want to understand where are these URLs pointing. And a good way to interpret these URLs, not the way a human eye will read it, but the way the browser will read it, is to use netdaemon.net. It allows you to paste a URL in, and it's going to interpret it so that federalpolice.com, it turns out that actually it's a username, and Article 872, a browser would treat that as a password. And the actual website that you're going to be going to is represented in decimal, but this, if you convert it into IP address notation, is actually an IP address. 64.29.173.91. Isn't that tricky? You can represent IP addresses using decimal numbers. Who knew? Well, Nadima knows. So, it's a good idea to investigate these links to see, well, where are they actually pointing? And there are clever ways of obfuscating these URLs. And this URL here is actually pointing to the same IP address. It's just that it's a different way of representing that IP address. So, now you know where it's going. You can go there as well. And this is the source code to that website. This is what you would find. Let's take a look at it. Most of this is HTML. There's the body tag that says that this is going to be a web page with a background color of white. And the text on the page will say, server error 550. So the user is being social engineered to just kind of say, oh, well, server error. I'm going to come back tomorrow. But actually, if you look at the source code, you will see that there's an applet tag. Applet tag allows the website to embed a Java applet in the page. And what is a Java applet? A Java applet is a program written in the Java programming language, and it is written specifically so that it can run within the browser. So to get one thing straight, Java is a programming language that is completely different from JavaScript. No relation. They just decided to confuse the world by using Java in both names. JavaScript is a scripting language that uses a totally different syntax than Java, the programming language. So, an applet is a program written in Java so that it runs within the sandbox of the browser. And to run it, of course, you need to install Sun Java Runtime Environment. Otherwise, an applet won't run. And this applet is supposed to run within a sandbox. It's not supposed to have access to the local file system, to the network. It's supposed to be very limited in what it can do. Well, let's look at the way a browser will interpret this tag. When a browser sees this, it'll say, well, I gotta execute this Java program, but where do I get the Java program to run? Well, the archive tag says that the program that the browser is supposed to execute is a Java program stored on this web server in a file javautil.zip. You see, a lot of Java programs are actually comprised of multiple files that have an extension .class. To be able to package these files into a single file, developers typically zip them together using zip. Although most of these files that are zipped up have an extension .jar. A jar file is just a regular zip file, but it looks cooler because it's got a .jar extension. It's the same thing. In this case, they're not trying to be pretentious. They're just saying javautil.zip. A browser would find this tag, download this Java archive file, extract it, and now it is almost ready to run the Java program. Except that it needs to know which of the class files within this archive is it supposed to run first. That's the purpose of the code tag. And it says, hey, there are going to be multiple files here. The one that you should run is called blackbox.class. That's how it's supposed to work. Now, when I downloaded this zip file and I tried to extract it, it wouldn't extract. And it was embarrassing how long it took me to figure out that it's actually just a regular Windows executable, not a zip file. Now, a browser is not going to be that stupid that it's going to just see an executable and try to run it. It's not that bad. So the browser will fail to extract the zip file, and it's going to say, you know what? Couldn't deal with this one, but let's see if the web server is hosting this class by itself. And yes, it was hosting. A browser downloaded this class file by itself, executed it, and this class file was written to exploit a vulnerability in Java Runtime Environment. And that vulnerability allowed the website to download and execute this as a normal Windows executable. So that's how this attack worked. Very little code to implement an attack like this. And if you got this zip file and you realize that it's actually a regular Windows executable, you would try to analyze it, and PID would tell you that it's protected with FSG, which is a packer. I came across an unpacker that automatically unpacked it for me, and I can do some analysis and realize that it was a keylogger of some sort. But the reason I wanted to show you this particular attack is because this is what a lot of the modern attacks are like. They involve an email message or an instant message or maybe a social networking message to bring the user to a website. They involve some kind of a client-side exploitation, and there's oftentimes HTML or JavaScript involved in implementing that, or in this case, it was Java. And then, in many cases, ultimately, there's the local Windows executable that you still need to analyze the way we've been discussing so far in the course for the most part. That's what a lot of the attacks are like, these multi-stage attacks, and that's what I wanted to share with you. We're going to revisit this topic with malicious JavaScript on the last day of the class. But the topic that I wanted to cover now is how to analyze malicious programs that run within a browser that are written in Flash. Because this right now is a pretty significant attack vector. Now, as a developer looking to create a flashy, interactive, animated website, Flash is a pretty attractive platform. It runs almost anywhere, right? There's a single major platform where it doesn't run, the iPhone. But everywhere else it runs, so it's pretty attractive to developers. Ultimately, it's almost the promise of write once, run everywhere. It's a pretty capable programming environment, so it's not surprising that attackers are attracted to it as well. Because as an attacker, you can write your code in Flash and you can target a whole lot of users using it. The goal of an attacker is to write a program in Flash. Now, program in Flash is typically created to have an extension .swf. SWF. But people don't say SWF. It's not cool. What you want to say is SWIFT. So if you're in the know, you say, oh, these are SWIFT files. That really means it's a Flash program. The Flash program, what can it do? Well, it can try to target a vulnerability in Flash Player, those are quite popular. A lot of these SWIFT files simply try to redirect the user to another website that might launch another attack on the browser. How does an attacker get the victim to execute his Flash program within his browser? Well, several ways to do that. One popular one is to simply buy advertisements. The attacker is willing to spend money. They create a banner ad implemented in Flash that looks like they're advertising a legitimate service. They contact a legitimate advertising company and they say, I would like you to run my ad on all of your web properties. I'm going to pay you real money for it. The advertiser looks at the ad, says, okay, no problem, and puts the ad onto the many popular websites. Now victims, potential victims, go to those websites. Their browser loads the ad, but because the ad is implemented in Flash, the Flash program ends up targeting the user. It's a common way to do this. Attackers are willing to invest some money to target users, also especially since they're probably not paying with their own funds anyway. So that's a popular attack vector. Another popular attack vector is to compromise legitimate websites through a technique like SQL injection and get those compromised websites to serve malicious Flash programs to their victims. Also, it could be as simple as just emailing users using spam to get them to click on a link. So, I wanted to start with this example. This attack began with an email message. The email message used Latin alphabet characters, but it was actually written in Russian. And translated, the message has the subject, what's up? What's up? My girlfriends, exclaims the message, and gives you a link to a website. The implication is that by clicking on this link, you will be able to view my girlfriends, right? The link is a link to a SWIFT file. So when you click on this link, the browser will load this as a Flash program, and the Flash program will execute in the victim's browser. This SWIFT file is hosted on ImageShack.us. Anybody knows of ImageShack? ImageShack.us is a pretty popular website that allows you to freely host images. There's nothing malicious per se in that website. It'll host any image you upload to it for free. And it'll also host SWIFT files for free as well. So attackers oftentimes use it to host their malicious programs there. Why not? It's free. So what happens when you click on this link? Let's say somebody in your organization got it and asked you to investigate. Well, before I show you what happens when you click on a link, let's say that you download the SWIFT file using wget. You put it into your lab And now you got to figure out what's the deal with the Swift file. What can it do? Because Flash is very capable. It could do a lot. The challenge in analyzing Swift files is that we need to bring into our toolkit a whole new set of tools. That's because Swift file is not a regular Windows program. It's not x86 assembly, OliDebug, IdaPro. They have no idea how to interpret Swift files. They are of no help. So we need to have specialized tools that know how to interpret Flash bytecode. And the tools that are available to do this kind of stuff are pretty immature. So this is going to be pretty challenging. I'm going to show you some simple examples, but I'm also going to show you some complex examples. This Swift file that I got there. Let me close the window here so that it's easier for you to see the screen. All of these examples, of course, I got in your environment on Remnix. The one that I'm analyzing now has this name of, well, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, but it's ZOX, etc. So you download that Swift file from the malicious website, you bring it into your lab, and now what do you do with it? Well, the first step that I like to do is to extract all the components, all the objects that are embedded into the Swift file. You see, a Swift file can have a lot of multimedia components in it. You can embed scripts in it, written in ActionScript. You can embed images, you can embed movies, you can embed sounds. Swift Extract is a free tool that's part of the Swift Tools toolkit. It's installed on Remnix. It's open source. And there are versions that run on Windows too. And Swift Extract, if you point it to the Swift file, it'll show you all the objects that are embedded into the Swift file, like fonts and images and so on. I want to take a look at the image embedded in there. It looks like it's identified as ID number 2. And it's a PNG file. So to extract it, what I got to do is I say Swift Extract dash P number 2. Because number 2 is the ID of the PNG file. And this will create a local file that I can look at. There is an image viewer built into Remnix. It's a tool called FEH, F-E-H. And it's actually a pretty good tool, despite its name. And it allows you to look at a picture. Why do I care to see this? Because a lot of these malware attacks, a lot of these campaigns using Flash programs are related. You've got the same set of groups that are behind them. And by looking at what objects are embedded into the Swift file, you might be able to identify attacks that are related to each other. For example, the image that's embedded in this particular Swift file seems to be advertising some Russian tour agency. In itself, there's nothing malicious about that, but maybe you have seen this before as part of another attack. Maybe that will help you connect the dots and make some kind of and connect two distinct incidents to each other. So it's useful to look at embedded images, and Swift Extract makes it pretty easy. Now, how do you look at the scripts embedded into a Swift file? In many cases, a tool that'll do this quite well is called Flare. Flare is a decompiler for Flash scripts. A decompiler is better than a disassembler. A disassembler would show you raw low-level instructions. A decompiler actually tries to show you what the original script would have looked like, something close to the original source code. So Flare is installed on Remnix. You run it, you parse the Swift file with Flare. This will create a file with a .flr extension. And if you look at it, it will show you the embedded scripts. And the script embedded into the Swift file, in this case, is relatively simple. Now, the language is ActionScript. ActionScript is very similar to JavaScript. And even if you don't know ActionScript, you can probably tell what's going on here. It calls getURL with a given URL. So most likely what's happening here is when the victim loads the Swift file in their browser will execute the script and it will redirect the user to this URL. mayapodrushka.com with some identifying information. So that is what's going on in this particular attack. Why do they want to redirect the user to that URL? Well, maybe they want to attack them, or maybe not. Here's what was at that URL, actually, in this particular case. I thought I had an image. Hold on a second. Oh, yes. Here's what was on that site. Now, I spent a lot of time clicking through the site to see if it's malicious or not. It took me a lot of time.
2 weeks was a
little long. And as far as I could tell, it's not trying to attack you. It just wants your credit card. It wants you to pay them money to see all the details about the women displayed here. So doesn't look like an attack per se, just a foil to get some money out of you. The thing about this particular Swift file is, where is that URL embedded in the Swift file? If you look at its strings, you won't see the URL in there. And that's because most of these Swift files are actually compressed. So if you look at the Swift file and you try to extract the strings, you won't see anything useful. There's a convenient way to extract, to decompress the Swift files. And my favorite tool for doing that is FLASM. FLASM is a flash disassembler. I don't like it. It doesn't work very well. But it does have this wonderful parameter -x that will decompress the Swift file for you. So if you want to decompress it, just use FLASM -x. And it's going to decompress the file. And now you can look at the embedded strings and you see the URL right there. So pretty convenient. I thought I'd share that with you. FLASM is also installed on Remnix.